we found a good rewrap Maxwell's equations as those two. And this obviously simplifies everything about the theory. There's just less to remember. And it contains all the same information that was present in all of Maxwell's initial writing of the equations. So notice in particular that it's obvious from these equations that the current is conserved, right? Notice, so let's call that one one and that two. If I take the divergence of one, gives me d nu d mu f mu nu equals minus mu naught d nu j naught j nu. But of course this is zero because partial derivatives commute and f is antisymmetric. Sorry?
Do you want to scream now?
No, in the break.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Okay. Okay. Oh. Okay. Not quite perfect timing. Let's see if we can get rid of it. Sorry, can you take the screen up? Okay, I'll write over here while he's doing that. So it's interesting to consider the action for these equations of motion. As we will see momentarily, the action is a very, very powerful thing. As you walk into perimeter, you should see the action for everything. Have you noticed that? Is it still up? It is still up there. Okay, so hopefully in this course I'm showing the first part of that action. And so it all begins with Maxwell. And the second part involving the Einstein-Hilbert action we'll show shortly. And then you've only got Dirac and Higgs to go. And you know the action for everything. So it's all within your grasp. Okay, so let's ask, do these equations follow from a variational principle? Okay, so we want to write down an action whose variation yields these equations of motion. And the first step is to notice from this equation that I can automatically satisfy this equation if I regard f. So first step, set f mu nu equal to d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And then, as we discussed yesterday, we automatically satisfy equation two. Okay, so we're going to regard the A mu as the quantities to be varied, but always define F this way. And in that way, we ensure this equation two is always satisfied. Okay, so what's the action going to be? So I'm just going to write down the answer and then verify it. So an action for a field like F, F is a function of space-time, space and time coordinates, so you have to integrate over all of space-time. So what this means is, of course, c dt d3x, right? This is the volume element on space-time. And then it turns out the right action is minus a quarter mu naught f mu nu, f mu nu, plus j alpha, a alpha. Okay, so we will show momentarily, it's actually it's almost obvious that this volume element is a scalar under Lorentz transformations. If I do a Lorentz transformation, actually, let me show it now. You know that the volume element, d4x prime, is the Jacobian, right? The determinant of this 4x4 matrix times d4x from standard integration theory. And then if we have x prime equals lambda x, I'm not bothering to put the indices in, then we see that dx prime dx, the Jacobian matrix, is just lambda. And so this is equal to determinant of lambda d4x. And providing we're dealing with the connected component of the Lorentz transformations, this will be plus 1. So this volume element is Lorentz invariant. And these quantities I've written down are all Lorentz invariant too. So this looks like a good invariant quantity under Lorentz transformations. And basically, that's the secret of the action. The action is so important because it incorporates all the symmetries in the theory in an absolutely manifest way. OK, so now we take this action, and let me just elaborate that a little. I emphasized last time that the equations involve both f up and f down, right? And it's the same here in the action. There's an f down and an f up. Now let's just think carefully. F down I've already defined, right? F up is, of course, eta mu alpha eta nu beta, and then d alpha a beta minus d beta a alpha, OK? Whereas this is regarded as d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. OK, so the action involves eta. And if the action's going to be Lorentz invariant, eta has to be Lorentz invariant. So eta prime has to be eta. And everything else has to transform in accordance with these Lorentz transformations. And then it will all be invariant. And so when we vary the action, we vary it with respect to the vector potential with lowered indices. Okay? So when I vary it, so we vary with respect to a mu. It's going to be rather important, especially when we come to gravity, to be rather clear about what you're varying. And you have to take care of whether it's upstairs or downstairs. And so on. So let's now vary this action. So when I vary the action, what I'm doing, of course, is calculating the action as a function. Actually, it's a functional, but let's not worry about that. This action depends on a mu. And what I'm calculating is the difference between the action with the with the variation and the action without the variation. That's what this means, okay? The variation of the action. And then I'm only going to keep it to first order. To first order in delta A mu. And that's the definition of the variation. So it's kind of the derivative of the action with respect to a mu. So when I vary it, you see that delta S is equal to this integral minus, now there are these two terms. There's eta's around. But essentially, this is a square. So when you vary it, you expect to get a factor of 2. And then you notice there are two terms here. And if I vary one of them, this will multiply it. If I vary the other one, the same thing will multiply it. And of course, the indices are reversed here, but there's a minus sign. So I'm also going to get the same thing. OK, so basically, when I vary it, I get a factor of 2 because there are two f's. another factor of 2 because they're two A's. And so I get minus 1 over mu naught d mu delta A nu F mu nu. OK, you see, if I've kept this other term, I just use the fact that that F is anti-symmetric, and it means that the variation of this is the same as the variation of that. OK, so that's what I get from the first term. And then the second term, I get J alpha delta A alpha. I don't vary J. This is the current. Doesn't depend on A. And I set that equal to 0. And then, as usual, when you vary actions, you're allowed to integrate by parts, because you regard the variation as being arbitrary between the boundaries of the integral. So I integrate by parts, ignore the variation on the boundaries, and so if I integrate by parts, this becomes, the whole term becomes plus 1 over mu naught delta A nu d mu F mu nu. OK, so what I get here is integral 1 over mu naught F d mu F mu nu plus J nu delta A nu d 4x. OK, so I just relabeled this index nu so that I could combine the two terms as a coefficient of the same thing. And this is 0 for all delta A nu, any function of x. And therefore, the coefficient of the variation must be 0 if the variation is 0. And so therefore, we get that this equals 0, which is the equation we wanted. OK, so that's the variational principle for electrodynamics. And in fact, it is the model upon which a whole standard model is built. So Maxwell's theory is called a U1 gauge theory. It has the simplest gauge invariance. We discussed gauge invariance yesterday. The weak interactions are SU2 gauge theory, and they have exactly the same action with another little index on the F, and the SU3 is the strong interactions. And so that kind of generalization, even though it took almost 100 years, is really not too impressive. Okay, so Maxwell really had this, he's responsible for the real breakthrough in fundamental physics. I'll say some more about that in a moment. OK, good. So we've discussed fields, the field tensor, F mu nu, and how we formulate Maxwell's theory in terms of fields and with an action. And so now let's consider the other element of physics, which is particles. So we have fields, we have particles. The particles interact through these fields. In fact, that whole picture came about through Maxwell. That Maxwell's real step forward was to introduce the notion of fields. Let me just check if this is. Yeah, that's good. OK, so particles. So let's think about a particle moving in space and time. Following some world line. OK, this is called the world line of a particle. You could label it with some parameter, lambda. So lambda, in order to be a good label for this world line, lambda would have to be a number which varies monotonically along the line, okay? So that every point on the line has a unique value of lambda. That would be a good way to parameterize the line. So if I tell you the value of lambda, you can uniquely tell me which point in space-time the particle is sitting at, is located at. And so, of course, this is CT and X as the functions. Both CT and X are functions of lambda. Now, when we look at a particle moving in space-time, obviously, if it's static, it just moves vertically, right? Static. Constant velocity, it would be doing this. And actually, we saw yesterday how the Lorentz transformations take you from one to the other by changing space-time coordinates. But in general, it'll be following some kind of curve like this if it's accelerated. If it it feels some force, it'll be following a curve. Now, some definitions. We consider a small element of the trajectory, dx mu. Okay, so you should think of that as a small arrow in space-time, just telling you which way the particle is going. And we consider the following: the length, the Lorentz invariant length of dx mu. Lorentz invariant length of dx mu. So it's equal to this. So that's some quantity that everybody would agree what the value of this is in any Lorentz frame. Because if I Lorentz transform the x, I just get lambdas. And then lambda eta gives me eta. So this is something upon which all observers will agree. And if we just write it out, this is minus c squared dt squared plus dx squared. If this quantity is less than zero, we say the curve is time-like. Okay? Curve is time-like at that point. Okay, so the dx mu is the tangent to the curve at this point, at that particular value of lambda. And if this interval, Lorentz invariant interval, is negative, we say it's time-like for obvious reasons. That means that the dx squared is smaller than this term. If it's equal to zero, we say it is null. Again, for obvious reasons, it has no Lorentz invariant length. And if it's bigger than zero, we say it's space-like. Okay, so for massive particles, or let's just say it this way, massive particles, I'll just state this now, we'll see it later, follow time-like world lines. If a particle has a mass, it has no option but to remain time-like. It's very sad for us. We have to keep getting older, right? If only we could go space-like for a while, we could stop aging. And if we could reverse our direction in time, that would be even more interesting. But we'll see that's not possible in relativity. So massive particles, if they're going to the future, they have to keep following a time-like future-directed world line. Massless particles, like the photon or the graviton, follow null world lines. And then tachyons, so these are fictitious kind of particle, which don't exist, which don't exist, would follow space-like world lines. And if they did exist, they would lead to all kinds of paradoxes, that you could send information backwards in time using tachyons and so on. So these are the only two physical cases. So some more definitions. So we define tau to be the proper time along the world line. Sorry, I should say for massive particles. So let's specialize to massive particles where this interval is negative. So they are, the trajectory is time-like. And if that's the case, we can define the proper time to be such that via d tau equals square root of dt squared minus dx squared over c squared, or in other words, minus eta mu nu dx mu dx nu over c squared. And that's obviously Lorentz invariant, but it only makes sense if this quantity inside the square root is positive. So it's Lorentz invariant, and what is it physically? Well, it's equal to the time interval, dt, in a Lorentz frame in which dx is zero. Okay, so if I take this particle world line, and I do a Lorentz transformation to make that particle static, okay, so dx is zero, then d tau is just the time. So d tau equals dt in the Lorentz frame where the particle is static. In other words, dx equals zero. So that's the meaning. If a particle is carrying a clock with it and you want to know the reading of the clock, it will be given by d tau, because according to the particle, so the clock is the time measured in the frame in which the particle is static. And so just writing this out again, we can just pull the dt. So in general, in a general frame, d tau is dt times the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is dx dt is the velocity of the particle. And we define this to be dt over gamma, where gamma by definition, is 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared. And we saw gamma come in last time. So the total proper time along the particle world line, tau is integral d tau, is integral dt over gamma. Now, some other quantities, the four velocity of the particle, u mu, is dx mu d tau. And so this is equal to gamma c comma v. Okay, because d tau is dt over gamma, x zero is ct, and xi dxi dt is v. By the way, you may notice that I've just been careful to keep the dimensions correct everywhere. Many books you will find they don't bother and they set c equals 1, and then you lose track of the dimensions. I think for a first time through, it's good to leave it in and then check everything is actually meaningful dimensionally. If I call something a four velocity, that means its dimensions are velocity. Okay, so that's why there's a c in here. Gamma is dimensionless. These are velocities. When I define the four momentum, this is the mass times the velocity, and this is called the rest mass of the particle. So that's a number which doesn't change with Lorentz transformations. And the four momentum p mu is just that number, the mass times the velocity, in analogy with the usual definition of momentum in Newtonian mechanics. Now, there's one more component of the momentum than there is in Newtonian mechanics, and it's interesting to ask what it is. And we're going to go into some detail to understand that. And of course, when we do understand it, we will understand the formula E equals mc squared, because the time component of this is the related to the energy. So let's, to understand that properly, let's consider the action for the particle. And we'll see it in a moment how the energy and the momentum are derived from the action. So what's the action for a particle? So I'm just going to, I want to write down something which is Lorentz invariant. Okay, so I'm going to consider trajectories of the particle, ct and x. And I want the action to be a function of the trajectory, such that when I vary the trajectory, I get the equations of motion of the particle by insisting the action is stationary. So what's a good thing I could write down? That's all I have. I have this trajectory, x mu of lambda. So the action must be a function of that. And what function should it be? So I've told you enough.
There should be indices contracted.
Yes, there should be some indices contracted. So I need some invariant quantity. What invariant quantity could I possibly use? So here's my trajectory. What invariant can I form?
The length.
Just the length. Yeah, just the length, the total length of this line. the Lorentz invariant length of this line. Okay, so I consider a little piece of the line that has an invariant length, d tau, and I just integrate d tau. The total length of the line is Lorentz invariant. Everybody will agree what it is, no matter what Lorentz frame. So that's a good candidate for the action. So I'm going to write down integral d tau, which is okay. Well, actually, d tau is this over c. Okay, because this is c squared dt squared, right? So I need to factor of 1 over c. Now, this doesn't have the right dimensions for an action. What is the dimensions of an action? What are the dimensions of an action?
Times
t. Yeah, not bad. Not bad, but no. What's the statement? Not bad, but no cigar. What's the dimensions of the Lagrangian? The dimensions of the Lagrangian is energy. Good. So the dimensions of action should be E t, and then of course. The way to think about that is you're going to take this action in quantum mechanics and multiply it by I over h bar, and this will give you the quantum amplitudes. H bar has dimensions of e times t. Another way of writing it is it's the same dimensions dx times p, right? Because p is h. So these two things have the same dimensions because e is a half mv squared. P is mv, so this is mass length squared over time, and here I have mass length squared over time. So yes, the action has dimensions t times energy. In fact, Planck knew that, and if you look at Planck's paper, he says, I'm going to introduce this constant, and what is it? It's a quantum of action. Okay, so Planck actually knew that in 1900, but it took people quite a while to actually write the laws of physics in such a way that this was the way in which H entered. But Planck knew what the dimensions were, and he thought that was fundamental. He's a pretty clever guy, Planck. I mean, he invented the Planck mass and all these things long before quantum mechanics was really understood. Okay, so we need to make this thing have dimension. Currently, it has dimensions of time. We need to multiply it by something which is units of energy. Okay? So can you think of anything which I could use to multiply the action? I've introduced this mass. Okay, so that's some help. That's not energy. C squared, yes. So a half mv squared as units of energy. We don't want v in there, but we can use c. C has the right units. And so this turns out to be the correct action. The only thing that's wrong with it is the overall sign. And I'll justify that in a moment. So let's cancel the c's. This is the action. We'll justify this momentarily. This has units of energy times time, okay? So, or p times x. This is p, and this is x, right? This is the interval in x. So this has dimensions of length, and this is mass length over t. So it's ml squared over t. Good, so this has the right units, and I will justify the sign in a moment. So let's write this out in a little bit more detail. Integral dt square root 1. Let me just mention one thing. This is a little bit weird to write it this way. I had x as a function of lambda. I want the action to be a function of x of lambda, of the trajectory. But that's easy to fix because what I will do is just put in d lambdas there. And then put a d lambda here, okay? And because of the square root, the d lambdas actually cancel. And so the action is a function of the Lagrangian is a function of the of the parameter velocity. We've not said what lambda is here at all. Okay, so the action depends only on this dx mu d lambda. And what you notice is this action has a very beautiful property, which is it is reparameterization invariant. Invariant. Okay, namely, if I change lambda to lambda twiddle of lambda, or lambda prime of lambda, any function of lambda, which is still monotonic, you know, the important property of lambda is that it varied monotonically along the line. As long as this lambda prime is still monotonic, which basically means that d lambda prime d lambda should not vanish. Okay, so that if lambda changes by d lambda prime also changes. As long as that's true, then I can just change coordinates, and of course, it's equal because the d lambda canceled anyway. So this is a very nice action. And it means that we can pick lambda to be anything we like. Okay, and the action is identical. In particular, we can pick lambda to be t. Why not? T is a good parameter. For every t, I know where I am on the world line. And so let's just pick lambda to be t. So in fact, this is what I'm doing here. I'm saying d lambda is dt. And then what I have is 1 minus 1 over c squared dx dt squared. Okay, so that's the action for the particle. And let me try and justify the minus sign now. So in particular, we expect to reproduce Newtonian mechanics. We hope to reproduce Newtonian mechanics when the velocity is small, smaller than the speed of light. Okay, so then I should expand. So if v over c is much less than 1, then this is equal to minus m naught c. Sorry, I left out a c here. Right? There was a m naught c here, and this includes this interval here is minus c squared dt d lambda squared plus dx d lambda squared. So this is another c here. So this minus m naught c squared integral dt. And then just expand the square root. And in fact, let me do it this way. Minus m naught c squared plus 1 half m naught v squared, or dx dt squared, plus higher order terms. Okay, so here we have the familiar kinetic energy, the Newtonian kinetic energy. And that's why I picked the minus sign overall, so that this minus sign and this minus sign conspire to give the right plus sign in front of the kinetic energy. And then the question is, what is this term? Okay, just a constant. So if I vary that action, I get nothing at all. Doesn't contribute. It's just a constant. But it looks like a potential energy, right? And the value of the potential energy is equal to m naught c squared. Okay, so that was the first clue that E equals mc squared. The potential energy of a particle is m naught c squared. And it's kind of a trivial clue, but it took a genius to see it. And that was Einstein. And in 1905, Einstein wrote a paper saying the energy of a particle is, the rest energy of a particle is mc squared. And it's a totally amazing paper, which I encourage you to read. It's 3 pages long. It has no references at all. It would not be published today, because everybody, all the referees would say, oh, you haven't referred to my papers. Okay. But it contained this amazing formula, E equals mc squared. There was actually a little bit more in his paper than this. He did a Gedanken experiment, which showed that if you had a particle and it decayed into another particle and 2 photons, then just by doing Lorentz transformations from one picture to the other, you could show that the energy of the photons must equal the change in mc squared for the particle. Okay, so absolutely brilliant paper, but the hint that the energy of the particle was mc squared was here. And actually, Einstein's thought experiment to prove E equals mc squared is completely unnecessary and was rendered unnecessary by a very extraordinary mathematical physicist. And who was that? Who's the person who really told us what energy is and how to derive energy? Yeah, energy is a pretty nebulous thing, right? It's very important, but what is it? Yes? Noether, Emmy Noether, right. Okay, so the correct derivation, or let's say well, we'll get to it, but yes, it was Emmy Noether. So let's go to Emmy Noether. So her history was, she had a remarkable history. She was not allowed to take a degree as an undergraduate because she was a woman. She was allowed to audit the classes, but she couldn't actually. They said to her, you'll never get a degree because women can't do maths. We know that. And so she took the classes and clearly was the best student. And so eventually they grudgingly gave her a degree. And then they allowed her to teach in the university. But again, because she was a woman, they wouldn't pay her. So her whole career, she was allowed to lecture in a degree. Well, this was while she was in Germany. She was allowed to lecture but not paid because it wasn't considered proper for a woman to be a professor. And then Hilbert, one of the greatest mathematicians of the day, and a number of other mathematicians recognized her when she came to a seminar and told her about various problems, including the problem of energy in general relativity. And they were very confused about it. What is energy in general relativity? Einstein was confused. Hilbert was confused. And Noether saw right through it and cleared up the problem completely, wrote 2 amazing papers, which are still very advanced. Well, are very advanced even today. Very, very deep papers, which people still refer to today. And then she sort of dropped physics. She said, this stuff is too easy for me. And she went on to invent the foundations of modern algebra. And so the great French and German mathematicians, Grothendieck and so on, were inspired by Noether's work. It's an even more amazing story. She was Jewish. The Nazis came to power. She had to flee Germany. She ended up in the US at Bryn Mawr College, a women's college in the US, and unfortunately died shortly after due to medical mistreatment, let's put it that way. So a rather sad story, but the following is Noether's idea. Okay, so let's say this is properly explained. By this, meaning the E equals mc squared, is properly explained by Noether's theorem. So note this theorem, and you'll see there's one clever idea in the theorem. Her papers are much, much deeper than this, but I'm just presenting that particular clever idea. And actually, I must say that the theorem is rather badly explained in most textbooks, in my humble opinion. You're welcome to look at all the explanations. Probably the best is in Steven Weinberg's book on quantum field theory. But I challenge you to really find that explanation transparent and clear. I think it's correct, but it's long and complex, and he does things in backwards ways. And this is not a particularly well-described theorem, in my opinion. But it's absolutely fundamental. So Noether's theorem. For every continuous symmetry of an action, and we're always going to take this up to surface terms. Okay, so we're always going to discard surface terms. There exists a conservation law. Okay, so this was a very, very profound idea, that when you have a conservation law, it doesn't occur for some random reason. It occurs because of a symmetry. So what symmetry do you think is the symmetry which gives rise to energy? What's the symmetry?
Time translation.
Okay, so it's actually a physical fact that the universe is almost the same from one time to the next. Why is that? Well, it's very old, and the expansion rate is rather slow. And so it's almost the same when you translate time. So it's not the same, actually. So it means energy is not conserved in the universe. But to the extent there is time translation symmetry, and there is a conserved energy. What's the symmetry for momentum conservation?
Space
translation. So the fact that the universe, again, all of these things come down to properties of the universe. The fact that the universe is pretty much the same here and there means that there is a conservation law called momentum. Yes?
You say that the universe isn't actually time translation invariant, but isn't time translation invariant a property of like your theory itself and not of the implementation of the theory?
No.
Like,
the universe is expandable.
Like if I take a sure. But like if I take
No.
If I take a quantum system, of which the Hamiltonian is translation invariant, then I can still take a state which is not translation invariant.
Yeah, you're not describing the universe.
Yeah, I know, but I'm asking a separate question.
So if you consider a static universe,
yes,
that is time translation invariant, and there will be an exact energy. So people who do ADS-CFT are considering a static universe, and they have an energy. It's nothing to do with the real world. Okay. So for every continuous symmetry of an action, sorry, I can't resist these controversial statements. I don't mean anything negative, but I really believe that by challenging each other, you improve your thinking. Okay? So I love being challenged, so challenge me. Tell me I'm full of crap. I'm happy to hear it. Okay? And then we'll discuss. And this is the ancient Greek tradition, and maybe even further back, that through disputation you make progress. So believe nothing I say, please. Argue with everything. Okay, so this is her theorem. Okay, it's really, really deep. It's saying that things are conserved not, because of symmetry, because of a mathematical property.
Also global.
What's that?
Not only continuous, but also global?
Yes, this is a subtle distinction. Actually, there is a symmetry. Well, yeah, we'll come to local symmetries later. But yeah, strictly you're right. So let me. I haven't defined symmetry yet. Okay. So let's put a global in. Okay. But when I define it, it will be global. Right. So the statement is that any continuous symmetry. In fact, I'm not really going to define a continuous symmetry, but I'll just define an infinitesimal version of it. Okay, so by definition, a continuous symmetry is one which has a parameter or parameters which can vary. There should be some special value of the parameters, like zero, for which the symmetry is just the identity operation. And you can always take a small value of the parameters. And this will give you the infinitesimal version. So let's assume we have some coordinates of the system we're describing. A will be an index running over all those coordinates. And this goes to qa prime of t, which is qa of t plus epsilon ab xb. And xb can be any function of q, q dot, and t. And what we refer to, these numbers are called the parameters of the symmetry. Okay, and I'm going to be interested in the limit where epsilon is small. This is what makes the symmetry operation infinitesimal. And these guys are called the generators of the symmetry. So these are not small. They're some explicit functions of the variables, q, q dot, and t. And you'll notice often I don't put the indices on things when they're inside the argument. Just to in order that we don't confuse them with the indices outside. But of course, these really do have indices. Yes?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm still a little confused with the conservation of energy thing. Okay. So there is dark matter and dark energy,
yes.
And that kind of messes stuff up in the conservation of energy thing.
No. No. The universe is expanding. That's what makes energy conservation.
But just the statement,
wrong.
The universe is like. Just the statement that the universe itself is not translation invariant,
yes.
does not per se imply that the theory is not translation
yes.
invariant.
No, it implies
that if you consider physical processes operating within this universe that is expanding, those physical processes won't be described by a Hamiltonian, which is time translation invariant. The Hamiltonian of the particles involves the metric, the geometry.
I can build a system of which the Hamiltonian is translation invariant, but
not in a
for which the
which
system
is
not, right? No, just, okay, just as an abstract notion, I define
well,
like,
if you
the
don't
system,
want to be in
yeah,
the universe,
yeah, just,
that's fine.
just for a second.
I think he's referring to,
I'm just trying to
the universe.
So, I'm just confused by what you're saying, so I'm just abstracting from the universe and trying to understand what you're saying.
I think I can.
There's a distinction. There's the real universe and there is a hypothetical universe. In a hypothetical universe which is static,
yes.
Indeed, there would be time translation invariant.
Let's forget about the universe for a second and just, okay, you only
that's
have
this.
No, because like sometimes it's good to abstract things so you can understand them and actually understand them in the real world might be too complicated at once.
No, it's not at all complicated. But anyway, let's leave it for now. We'll come back when we've done some derivations of energy.
I think I understand what you meant. Let's assume that the universe is some state of a deeper Hamiltonian. That Hamiltonian will have a conserved energy.
No.
If the universe is only a state of
no.
some
but
no.
physics...
My
no.
question is,
why should
is
it?
Just consider some...
It doesn't have to. And
no, it doesn't
if,
have
if,
to.
If in case that this, the universe is by chance a state of something that obeys some mechanical...
It works. Okay. Yeah. You're saying maybe
somehow the universe is magically described by Hamiltonian, which happens to be time translation invariant.
That's
maybe.
Not my question.
Oh, okay. Then that's not the interpretation.
My question is just: suppose you have a system which has a time translation invariant Hamiltonian, not the universe, just some system.
Yes.
Then my state that my system is in doesn't necessarily have to be time translation invariant.
The state is not
time translation invariant. No, it's not. In general, it's not. But what matters is if the action.
My point is, what you said is that the universe is not time translation invariant, because like we had a Big Bang and stuff.
Yeah.
Hence, no, Einstein, the theory is not. And that implication seems to not hold up.
I see what you're saying.
I'm not saying that your conclusion is wrong. I'm saying that.
I see what you're saying. And you're saying that it's possible that, if I could say it in other words, that the state of the universe sort of spontaneously breaks time translation invariance because it's a particular state. And nevertheless, the underlying Hamiltonian could be time translation invariant.
So it seems to me like you just made the observation that the universe is not time translation invariant, and hence your theory is not. And that implication doesn't hold.
No,
your conclusion might hold, but
the conclusion does hold. There is no time
translation symmetry in Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Does that satisfy you?
Yes.
Yes, I see your point. It's a valid point that just because one state of the system is not time translation invariant, it doesn't mean that the dynamics are not. But in fact, the dynamics are not. Okay. Right, so any continuous symmetry has an infinitesimal version. These parameters we will take to be small. And the generators are any function of the coordinates and the velocities. So we're doing Lagrangian dynamics. The Lagrangian will be a function of coordinates and velocities. And
so the generators can actually depend on the different positions?
Yes. No, the generators depend on the coordinates, the velocities, and the time in general. They can be any function. Okay, but it's got to be a symmetry. Okay, it's got to be a symmetry. So the action, of course, is the integral of the Lagrangian, which can be any function of the coordinates, velocities, and time. And here I'm only going to consider Lagrangians which involve first derivatives of the coordinates. If you want to consider Lagrangians with higher derivatives, there is an appropriate generalization. But so far, doesn't seem to be needed for the physics we know. All the Lagrangians we know can be written in this form. And OK, so this is the statement. Now, the fact this is a symmetry means that if I calculate delta S, and by delta S, I just mean S prime minus S, right? I mean S, where I have these primed, minus S without the primes. I take the difference. I calculate to first order in epsilon. And if it is a symmetry, the result should be zero up to surface terms. OK, so this is equal to integral dt, and the variation, yes, so the variation, so if epsilon ab is constant, the variation, well, let's see. Let me write it out again. So this thing here, so star is a symmetry if delta S equals zero for epsilon for constant.
That's a global thing.
Yes. global symmetry.
So just to clarify, it doesn't matter if xb is constant, that can vary in time degenerative.
Yes, exactly. So it's only a symmetry if you have this continuous parameter. You don't let the parameter depend on time, then it would be a local symmetry. Okay, but let's consider the global symmetry, which is much simpler. You just have some number, some continuous number, epsilon, and we call this a symmetry. If delta s equals zero, this is again up to surface term for constant epsilon. Okay, so that's Noether's first theorem. Actually, Noether's first paper is about this case, and her second paper is about the local symmetries. They also result in something very important called Bianchi identities, but we probably won't cover that in this course. Okay, so the trick, Noether's trick is very simple, which is to let epsilon AB be a function of time. Okay? So it's a little bit confusing because we're only really interested in global symmetries, but nevertheless, mathematically, it's a nice, we will derive the result by allowing epsilon to be a function of t. So let's do that variation. And when we do the variation, well, what do we demand of the variation? It must be that when epsilon is not a function of t, the variation is zero up to surface terms. Okay, that was the definition of the symmetry. Okay, so it follows that when I do this variation, the only possible result I have is epsilon dot AB, JAB, this is a function of Q, Q dot, and T. So this is fine, because if epsilon is a constant, this term will be zero, right? So that term is compatible with this being a symmetry. And there's another term you could write down, which is, you see, it has to be first order in epsilon, because the Lagrangian involves only first derivatives of Q. It can only involve epsilon and epsilon dot. So it must be linear in epsilon and epsilon dot. The epsilon dot term can multiply anything, and this will be a symmetry. But the epsilon term has to multiply a total derivative. Okay, so these are the only terms consistent. These are the only possible terms consistent with star being a global symmetry of the action.
Epsilon dot is small as well?
Yes. Yes, we treat epsilon as small and epsilon dot also small. Just as we usually do in variations. We treat delta x as small and delta x dot as small. Okay, so now you notice that if you integrate by parts, we get epsilon AB d by dt KAB minus JAB. Okay, plus surface terms, which I ignore. Okay, so now comes the clever part of the argument. This had to be true because epsilon was a symmetry. But now I have this equation, Now I have this equation, which is valid if epsilon is any function of time. I can regard epsilon differently. I can regard epsilon as a variation of the action, not as a symmetry, but as a variation. Okay, so epsilon, so star is also this is for epsilon being a function of t. Let's write it out again. For epsilon a b, for any epsilon a b of t, star is a legitimate variation, right? And so delta s equals zero via the, well, if and only if the equations of motion are satisfied. And so it must be true that follows from this that if the equations of motion are satisfied, then d by dt of kab minus jab equals zero, and that's our conservation law. Okay, so this is what Noether tells you. You take your action, which has a symmetry. You allow the symmetry parameters to be functions of time. You vary the action. You integrate by parts to remove the symmetry parameter outside here. And you say, aha, this is a legitimate variation. It must be that the variation vanishes if the equations of motion are satisfied for any epsilon. And therefore, it must be that this coefficient vanishes. And that's a conservation law. OK, so it's a very clever and simple argument. Let's just do a trivial example, a free particle. Integral 1/2 mx dot squared dt is the action in Newtonian, a free Newtonian particle. And let's consider the symmetry x goes to x plus epsilon, translation invariance. Okay? And I'm going to let this epsilon be a function of time. So delta s will equal integral m, and then x dot. Sorry, sometimes I use inconsistent notation. I'll try and put arrows over all the vectors. So the variation of the action is just this. If epsilon is a function of time, this means that, so x prime, x goes to x plus epsilon of t. So delta of x is epsilon of t. And so delta x dot is just epsilon dot of t. And so this is equal to integral mx dot epsilon dot. And then we integrate by parts. And so we get integral mx dot dot times epsilon. This is with a minus sign. And this should be 0 for all epsilon of t. And so it follows that d by dt of mx dot equals 0, which is momentum conservation. OK, so that's how Noether theorem gives you momentum explicitly. Let's do energy. So now let's consider a particle in a potential. So the action would be 1/2 mx dot squared minus v of x dt. So this is not translation invariant, right? Because I've got some potential that depends on x. So this action is not invariant under shifting x, but it is invariant under shifting t. If t goes to, if t prime is t plus epsilon, then obviously dt prime is dt. And so this is, the action is unchanged. So let's do time translation. So x of t goes to x of t plus epsilon. That's what time translation means. And that is approximately, for small epsilon, that is x of t plus epsilon, plus epsilon. Epsilon is a scalar quantity, x dot of t. So here we see that a time translation has a generator that depends on the velocity. In fact, it is just the velocity. And so now if S is this, delta S is equal to integral m x dot. So I'm varying this guy, get a factor of 2. And then from varying x dot, this implies that delta x is, of course, epsilon x dot of t. And delta x dot is the time derivative of the whole thing, dot. So when I vary this term, I get mx dot times epsilon x dot dot. OK? And then from varying the potential, I get minus v prime of x. In fact, I should really write that as the gradient of v. Gradient of v, varying this with respect to x, is the gradient of v times delta x, which is epsilon x dot. So now we integrate by parts. Minus mx dot dot epsilon x dot minus grad v epsilon x dot. And what we notice is that this is, as indeed Noether argued, it's epsilon times a derivative, right? Because the first term is the derivative of mx dot squared over 2. That's what this combination is. And the second term is the derivative of, let's see, minus sign. Yeah, I've got a minus sign outside. And the second term is the derivative of v of x. And so it follows that d by dt of 1/2 mv squared plus v of x equals 0. And that's energy conservation. OK? So that's Noether's theorem for the most familiar cases in ordinary mechanics. So now let's obviously, we want to do the same for a relativistic particle. And Nirtha will tell us exactly how to identify the energy and the momentum of the particle. So more generally, if S equals integral dl, L of Q, Q dot, and T, if S is translation invariant, then QA goes to QA plus epsilon A is a symmetry okay, and delta S, which is integral dl dQA epsilon A. So I just translate to Q, and L is a function of Q and Q dot. So the variation in the action first comes from varying Q, and then comes from varying Q dot, epsilon A dot. But this is zero by translation invariance. Okay, that's just saying the Lagrangian doesn't explicitly depend on the coordinate, it only depends on the velocity. And then Nirtha tells us, so Nirtha says, well, look at this term, integrate by parts, the coefficient of epsilon is a conservation law, and the conserved quantity is the momentum. Actually, I should really write it like that, is conserved. Okay, so Nirtha says that if our Lagrangian is translation invariant, then the momentum, corresponding momentum, is conserved. Now, time translations are a little bit more tricky. Shouldn't use that other board. I'll put these up when I've done with this. Time translations so of course the action will be time translation invariant if dl dt equals zero. Because, as I explained, if I simply shift t, dt doesn't change, and d by dt doesn't change. So the action's clearly invariant under time translations if the Lagrangian has no explicit dependence on time. But Nirtha says, look at it a different way, which is that qa goes to qa plus epsilon qa dot. Right, because all we're doing here is saying qa t plus epsilon minus qa of t. That's the effect of a time translation. So qa goes to this. Qa dot goes to qa dot plus epsilon qa dot, all dotted. the variation of the action is equal to integral dl dq epsilon qa dot plus dl dq dot epsilon qa dot all dotted. Okay, and as I said, the action is that has no explicit t dependence by assumption, so there's no other term. This is the entire variation of the action. So now we integrate by parts to get rid of the dot on that epsilon. So this is epsilon times dl dqa qa dot, the first term. And the second term, I get a minus sign d by dt dl dqa dot times qa dot. And that's it. And now we need to use a little clever identity, which is, you see, we're trying to represent this as a total time derivative. Okay? And it's not obviously a total time derivative. But in fact, if we calculate d by dt of L minus dl dqa dot qa dot, then what that's equal to is dl dqa qa dot. That's differentiating this term with respect to q. And now I need to differentiate it with respect to qa dot, a dot, and differentiate the qa dot. Okay, so that's coming from the first term. It's dl dq q dot, then dl dq dot q double dot. And the second term, I've got minus d by dt dl dq dot times q dot. And then I've got minus dl dq dot qa double dot. Okay, so I just differentiated this term with respect to t and got these two terms. Now you notice something nice. This term cancels this term. Okay, and so in fact we can write this as integral epsilon d by dt of L minus dl dqa dot qa dot. And anybody recognize this? You see this dl dqa dot we just derived as the Hamiltonian is the momentum. So what we've got is L minus PA QA dot. And what's that? That's the negative of the Hamiltonian, right? And so we conclude that d by dt of PA QA dot minus L equals 0. And this, by definition, is the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is so the Hamiltonian is conserved if the Lagrangian has no explicit t dependence, and that follows very precisely and very clearly from Noether's argument. Okay, so any questions? I think I'll break here and then will you come back in 5 minutes, not 15, and we'll figure out the energy and momentum for relativistic particle. And then what we're going to do is couple the particle to electromagnetism, and we will get all the laws of electrodynamics, including the Lorentz law, the force law on the particle, the way in which the particle is the current which drives the electric fields, and that will basically be it. So any quick questions? So isn't it amazing that Einstein or Hilbert didn't see this argument? I think you can see it's a little bit clever.
But what do you mean that they didn't understand?
Nobody knew what energy was before.
What that term was.
Pardon?
What that term was, or
maybe. No, they. Okay, so in practice, you know, Newton worked out his equation, F equals ma. Okay. And then he realized, well, if the potential is independent of time, there's a conserved energy. Right? So, but it was a kind of consequence of equations of motion. And then Hamilton developed the whole concept of Hamiltonians and blah, blah, blah. And people noticed that often things are conserved, but they didn't really know why. Okay? The new thing was the realization that symmetries give conserved quantities. So neither Hilbert nor Einstein realized that. And I would say people had no idea what energy was before that time. Noether realized, wow, the reason for energy is this time translation, which is a symmetry. It's not just a kind of random fact. It's a symmetry. And as soon as she'd realized that, people started to look for other symmetries. So if time translation, space translation, rotations. Rotations give rise to what? Angular momentum, yeah, so that derivation is exactly the same.
There's Lorentz in it, like the full Lorentz invariant.
Yeah, no, okay, so very good. So the Lorentz symmetry is quite a big symmetry, and it mixes space and time. So it doesn't quite fall into this class, because what was important in this argument is that we had a time, right? One preferred time.
Yeah.
And if you start changing the time, it's not clear how Noether's symmetry applies. So some of the Lorentz transformations it does apply to, in other words, rotations, are legitimate Lorentz transformations. But boosts mix space and time, and they do not give rise to conservation laws because they change time itself. Okay? So it's very important in the definition of the symmetry, there was always this T lying around, and that's some fixed time which doesn't get changed by the symmetry. But immediately people began to think, well, what about electric charge? That's also conserved, right? Maybe it's conserved because of some symmetry. What's the symmetry? It's the U1. It's the U1, and the symmetry is the phase of the field that carries the electric charge. Okay, so it's a phase symmetry, it's an internal symmetry. And once, so that was figured out, I think, by Schrodinger in the 20s or 30s. Okay, that the phase of the, well, they didn't have field theory then, but they said the phase of the wave function. The wave function later turned into a quantum field. So it was, again, a global symmetry giving rise to conservation law, in other words, charge. And once people had that idea, they said, oh, well, if a U1 symmetry can give a conservation law, what about trying SU2? Maybe that's important in physics. And that was where isospin, the whole notion of isospin, nuclear isospin, came from. And then, and also electroweak isospin, weak isospin. And then the strong interactions. This, what is this SU3? Well, it's exactly one of these symmetries. It is a global symmetry, and there are actually 8 conserved charges in the strong interactions. It's also a local symmetry. You see, if you have a local symmetry, you can always consider a subset that is a global symmetry, and then Noether's theorem is still true. So the weak interactions, the strong interactions, also have conserved charges. And really, Noether's insight, you could say, paved the way for the whole of 20th century physics, because all of 20th century physics became a search for these symmetries. But it took a sort of very mathematically inclined person to see that symmetry should be guiding principle in physics. And as I said, Einstein and Hilbert didn't see that. Okay, so we'll come back in 5 minutes and continue.